Okay, we resume our meeting. Rahul, please go ahead.
Okay. Thank you. So we will start with the second part of the contingencies paper. The second part of that paper discusses contingent features that result in cash flow that are not solely P&I. The paper presents three alternatives for the board's consideration. Alternative A proposes to retain the existing guidance in IFRS 9 and the proposed FASB's proposed ASU. Under that guidance, a feature that results in cash flow that are not solely P&I will be considered inconsistent with the solely P&I condition unless the feature is non-genuine, that is extremely rare, highly abnormal, and very unlikely to occur. Alternative B proposes a lower probability threshold than non-genuine in assessing contingent features. If the boards decide to pursue this alternative, the staff believe that the probability threshold should be set at remote and that reclassifications into the fair value P&L category should be required when the probability of the non-P&I cash flows occurring becomes more likely than remote. So it increases from remote. However, the staff recommends reclassifications out of P&L category should be prohibited. Alternative C, similar to alternative B, in that it proposes the remote probability threshold and reclassification into FVPL when the contingencies become more likely than remote. However, these requirements only apply to financial assets where a contingent trigger event is not meeting specified regulatory capital requirements that results in cancellation of debt or its conversion into equity instruments. Some staff members recommend alternative A, whereas others recommend alternative B. Those staff members that recommend alternative B believe that as long as non-P&I cash flows caused by a contingent feature have remote probability of occurrence, the asset meets the solely P&I condition because the likely cash flows remain solely P&I. Those staff members that recommend alternative A believe that the current non-genuine probability threshold is more appropriate and that genuine non-P&I cash flows are inconsistent with the solely P&I condition. These staff are concerned about the need for reclassifications and they note that users of financial statements do not support reclassifications. In addition, these staff members are concerned that from IFRS 9's perspective, replacing non-genuine threshold by a remote threshold would go beyond the scope of limited amendments to IFRS 9. Finally, these staff note that constituents express concern about particular instruments with remote non-P&I cash flow, such as bail-in instruments, rather than all instruments with remote non-P&I cash flows. So the first question, there are three questions in this section. So the first question is, which alternative does the board support? And based on the answer to that question, I would go into question two and question three. So with that, I will turn it over to the board for discussion.
Patricia.
I support alternative A, all contingencies that result in non-P&I cash flows fail unless genuine. It's easy to understand, I think, and if it's easy to understand, it should be easy to apply. And it wouldn't require continuous reassessment, which I think would be burdensome for preparers. And as was mentioned, users don't like reclassification. And it retains the guidance that's in IFRS 9. And my understanding is we never received any indication that this was a particular problem, so we didn't propose any changes in our limited scope amendments. And so I would stick with it.
Okay.
I support Pat in her argument. I think one of the criticisms that led to starting this project in 2008-7-9 time frame is to say that it's very complex. And I take that as a gospel of truth because we heard it very clearly. Of course, we have introduced OCI and all, we complicated it. I don't think we should go any further than that to do that. Here, I think the point is that, again, we are talking about certain places we do at origination, certain places we do reassessments on an ongoing basis, and I think that adds tremendous amount of complexity. And I think it's fair to say that at this point in time, especially for IFRS 9, I think we are starting from one point. adding reclassification. Again, we had a lot of debate on reclassification. We said it should be a tectonic shift. It should be so fundamental change you will allow reclassification. Again, adding reclassification here is diluting that point again. So I think where we are, I would suggest that at least for the IFRS 9 world, we got to stick with alternative ways. If it's a clean slate, maybe that's a different issue.
Philippe? Like before, I expressed my position to make sure I understand properly. Let's assume a bail-in instrument which has a conversion to equity feature if something happens. And let's assume the probability is assessed as being quite remote. I don't agree, but let's assume it's quite remote. Under A, it would fail. It would be fair value. Under B, it would pass. Under C, it would pass. Right?
Yes. Remote, yes.
Remote, yes.
Yeah. Remote. So I think I'm B.
Martin.
And I'm also B, because when I looked at an example, if you buy distressed debt or loan portfolio, and which really the probability that maybe the debtor offset really has a prepayment option, but situation I think where really it is unlikely that this prepayment option will be exercised, and that would lead to, I think, if we go to A, that all kind of this kind of loans which were by a bank or other investor already bought would have to be classified as fair values through P&L, and I think, I don't know if that is adequate, and therefore I really think if this is a remote stuff, why should we not then allow that, okay, it is amortized cost, because I think it gives useful information, and in an event really if this remote will change into probable or whatever, then to reclassify that.
But I think, just to be clear, you could make a decision on not genuine for this paper and make a different decision on prepayments in the other paper. So you could address just the specific example you gave in the other paper.
Yeah, but I think it must be consistent because it is maybe... Yeah. Therefore, I think I'm B, because if it is remote, why not doing that?
Mary?
Could I just ask a question to confirm my understanding?
Sure.
If we had an entity that had issued a pretty straightforward convertible debt, and so we're talking about the holder of that convertible debt, assuming that at the date of initial recognition by the holder, the convert feature was pretty far out of the money, I think alternative A would say convertible debt is not it would be difficult to judge a convert feature to be remote.
Right.
Option alternative B would say if the probability of conversion, of exercise of conversion, is remote, then it could be classified as amortized cost, and assuming reassessment, that's something that would be revisited. If it were classified as amortized cost, that would mean that presumably the holder is taking a reduced interest rate because it paid for the convert feature, and that the convert feature, you would just see the impact in a reduced interest rate compared to what it would be if there were no convert feature as it flowed through, because we're not separating, there would be no accounting for that convert feature. Is that correct in terms of a pretty straightforward convertible bond under A versus B?
So just to kind of explain it a little bit better, I guess. So in alternative A, it would not be difficult to argue that whether this feature is remote or non-genuine, it's clearly out. As soon as it's convertible, you get out of the FPPI condition. So there's no assessment there under alternative A. Yep. Under alternative B, the staff who supports alternative B believes that even if the the option is really out of money on the initial assessment, it would still be very difficult to assert that it would remain out of the money, and that's why it's remote, if you actually were able to get a compensation for that. So if there is the interest element is reduced because of this feature, then I think the assessment would still, to make it remote would be still very difficult. With regards to how this amortized method would work on this instrument, you're right. Yes, so it would be amortized over the period. Thank
you. So in practice, you would expect even under B that most, let's say, bail-in bonds would be at fair value.
Right. So like in U.S., in the final financial crisis, we have seen a lot of big institutions, you know, tier one. Yes. Most of the bail-in instruments are linked to the tier one capital, right? And we have seen that the tier one capital of very sound financial instruments have gone down. So it would be very difficult to assert that this situation happening is remote, because it of course happened. So the staff who supports alternative B doesn't believe that moving from non-genuine to remote would have a flood of instruments coming into amortized cost. It would increase it a little, but it would not be like there would be a flood and everything would be at amortized cost.
Well, then what's the point? Jim?
So I think if we were to head down this path, I would support B, in part because I feel like I've seen this movie before on liabilities and equity, where we had a very bright line that dealt with not solely principal interest, but whether something could be cash settled in the most remote of circumstances. And people went through the provisions of their agreements and found provision after provision that they said, well, did you really mean this feature? Even though it is so small, it's remote, it maybe not non-genuine, but remote, resulted in, you know, severe complexity in terms of applying the model. So I like the idea that features that don't have likelihood of occurrence at some level not driving the entire model.
So how does that differ from the de minimis?
De minimis means that the effect on the cash flows would only ever be small. Whereas here, if the remote event happened, the effect could be big. Yeah. You could change from having a debt instrument to owning ordinary shares.
You reclassify it.
You would reclassify, probable. But no, that's the difference between
them.
But as rules, Raoul said, you can't predict that.
It could be because of the bail-in.
You don't know.
But can you imagine the discussions we're going to have with investment banks about whether or not a convertible bond exercise is remote or not?
Is it in a convertible bond, is it that it's exercisable? So in other words, you can have a convertible bond where it's out of the money. You can have a convertible bond where you cannot exercise yet because the contingent event has not occurred. So is the contingency we're talking about an alternative being a convertible bond, is it that it's not exercisable or that it's out of the money, or is it both?
Or either.
Or both.
It's the likelihood of non-PNI cash flows occurring.
It's more that it's out of the money.
And one way to address that would be to say out of the money options aren't really contingent. I mean, obviously contingent on getting in the money, but you could say that's not a contingency we're looking at. That if there's no contingency on exercise other than increase in price, that's not the features we're trying to deal with.
You mean deep out of the money?
Yes.
Yeah, I would have said exercisable, not the pricing of the instrument. If it's not exercisable unless a contingent event occurs, I would assess remote. But if it is exercisable but it's out of the money, I think that's...
Well, what's the
difference? What about a knock-in
feature? If they're both remote, why...
But a knock-in feature. Knocks in based on...
I don't know how to evaluate whether or not something is going to be always remote if it's a matter of the underlying stock price.
But for example, bail-in bonds, couldn't you foresee enormous discussions with banks that say, listen, this financial crisis, first of all, it was not a solvency crisis, but a liquidity crisis. It was all caused by American subprime, and that won't happen again. And also, it was once. It only happens once every 60 years.
100 years.
So, chance of this bail-in bonds converted, pretty remote. Couldn't you get into that kind of discussion?
And that's why this is a tough one for me, because then after you went feature by feature in other circumstances, there were things that maybe made complete sense. But they said, look, the word says solely, and yours isn't solely. Things that I think people would have thought maybe in this context are traditional lending. Now, maybe that's captured by de minimis, but I think because de minimis is always de minimis in any circumstance, I just think operationality of the model is going to have issue after issue about did you really mean it.
Could the staff give an example of what they think would be precluded by A but would be permitted by B?
Bail and bonds, I think, in theory.
Assuming
that you think that the exercise of the bail and feature is remote, and the banks generally do, at least the IFRS banks generally do think that's remote, that's definitely genuine. It's a real feature that has, it's there for substantive purposes. So that would cause you to go to fair value through P&L under A, but under B or C, because it's scoped into C, if you could establish that it was remote, then the bail-in feature would mean that it could stay in amortized cost, and subject to reclassification assessment.
IPO is an example. Whether the IPO would happen or not, the assessment of whether the company would go through an IPO. One of the other examples, which is very common in U.S., is there's a condition in most of the debt arrangements that if you fail to file your financial statement with the regulator, there would be additional fees, or there would be increase in interest, or there would be some kind of correct feature included in that, and then you have to assess whether what's the criteria of you failing to file with the regulator your financial statements, and that's why this feature kicking in. It might be remote. And just one data point: remote currently exists in U.S. GAAP, so people do assess remote features continuously and then reclassify or recognize them as their value increases because of not being not remote. So I think in practice, this remote assessment is already there. So I guess from an operationality perspective, some staff believe that it would not be a concern.
And it's that fail to file feature, that is the type of thing that in other contexts, sort of feature after feature that have that type of feel to them change the entire model.
I also think when if you look at convertible bonds, I think you can look at the history of that company who has issued this convertible bond, and you can really make an assessment, is that remote or not, that people that the company will convert that. And I think really when if you can make this conclusion, I think amortized cost for a holder of that instrument is then better than fair value. And with the provision is, even that is then happening, then you had to reclassify and give the right fair values. And in the disclosure information, we have also the fair values. So I really don't think that this kind of features should then leading to the whole instrument then at fair value. That is what I think. And I would not agree that it is impossible to conclude, okay, that remote is not really given. Because I think looking at the history of issuers, you can make this judgment.
I support the alternative A here. Contingencies and putting aside prepayments for the moment, contingencies are something that are deliberately created in contracts with a view to achieve some type of end.
Depends.
Whatever they put in there for, there is a reason why they put into the contract. The fact that they put into the contract, the fact that there's a deliberate decision to put them in, means to me that means that there's a conscious awareness of them, if you like. They're out there and they've happened. Bearing in mind that we've already got the differentiation between genuine and non-genuine, so we're only talking about genuine ones here, only those that have a specific objective. It seems to me that people are going into it with their eyes open. I have a concern that the accounting becomes very complex if we go down a route B. what we effectively say is you'd assess remoteness at the beginning, then you continuously reassess. If you assess that it's not remote, it moves up to fair value. If you then later assess that it is remote again, it can't move back. So some of the stuff that's remote will be at fair value. Some of the stuff that's remote will be at amortized cost. So you create complexity upon complexity as you go along. And let's say, for me, these things are put into contracts for a reason.
Okay, Father.
Sure, Ross.
Do you believe a payment for a covenant violation would be something we're talking about here?
Does the staff think that a payment like that and the and the one that Jim mentioned before would fail solely P&I?
No, you don't. That's the thing. So I think it's a contingency.
I'm just wondering if we're solving for a real
contingency. You'd have to then you then would force someone to evaluate the point of the payment, right?
But the fact that if it is P&I, if it's still P&I afterwards, then you still pass. So that doesn't actually kick you out.
But if it's not, the entire thing's at fair value.
Correct. But if it's not, it would be cases like the bail-in features, it would be cases like the conversion features.
It's cases like what Jim Croker just talked about.
So fixed payments upon a covenant violation would fail.
Yeah. Right.
Not if there's not a significant difference in the interest rate as a result of it.
If I gave you additional warrants because I failed my covenant, I don't see how that covers principal and interest.
That's different, Russ. That's different. That's a protective covenant, and you're not recharacterizing the P&I when that happens.
Why?
Why not?
Why is it cash flow?
If it happens, also in variant B, it would turn to fair value.
It would if it happens.
Yeah.
But
then it's still not really significant.
A would kick you out.
A would kick me out.
Yeah, A would kick you out.
That's exactly the situation that I put this up for. Isn't it possible for you to have conversion features which have nothing to do with your share price but have to do with your financial performance? Mm-hmm. And the worse your financial performance triggers the conversion feature, and really it's a feature to effectively put you in the driver's seat as to how to protect yourself. I'm really reluctant to have those that you assess as remote at day one, if you did not elect alternative B, I would be reluctant to have those throw you into fair value when in fact it's just like any other debt covenant where a person can go in and get a board seat or what have you in order to minimize the amount of their loss.
I see that different because you're not recharacterizing the return to the investor as principal and interest. Here we're talking about features like a bail-in that's going to allow the regulator to defer the payment of interest, okay, and add interest to the principal. That's a different kind of instrument. And as Darryl said accurately, you put those features into these types of contracts for a purpose. The buyer knows that they're not buying solely P&I when those features exist. They're taking a bet on the performance of the company, okay, beyond just pure credit risk. They have to take into consideration now event risk of a regulator coming in. So
we're making a decision for all contingent features, aren't we?
It sounds like, Pat, that you would agree with the outcome I want, but I don't know how under alternative A, mm-hmm. when Darryl violates his covenant, and as a result of violating the covenant, he has to give me 10,000 warrants. I don't know how to read alternative A to be anything other than that instrument is now at fair value.
In fact, I could make a bail-in instrument restructured since the provisions were in covenants.
Well, if you're going to go for B here, and I have an open mind, then I think the arguments that Tom made about assessing variability of cash flows, okay, come into play here as well. And I think I can only see Tom ever voting for A here, okay, to be consistent with his prior arguments about variability. Okay, so you can't have it both ways, all right? At the end of the day, my end game here is convergence, okay, as well as improvements. And I'm willing to live with, you know, B. But A is clearly, the more pure theoretically sound approach here if you're trying to characterize what the investor is getting as solely P&I.
Tom is going to explain why perhaps not.
That's right. I'm an A person. But what I wanted to raise here is, do we really need a different threshold here? Right now, there's been a model that's developed with multiple thresholds. You have de minimis, which is a quantitative threshold of a certain variety.
you've got significance of a different threshold for evaluating principal and interest. You've got a non-genuine threshold of a certain probability threat indication that's now being replaced by a remote threshold, which is only a probability indication. Next memo, we're going to talk about getting in the same thing and saying not just a probability indication, measure fair value for the exception, which is a probability times quantity. Why are we introducing potentially four or five different thresholds?
Simplification.
Why not? If you're going to vote for remote, why not just change the genuine feature to a remote assessment and have it there and apply that throughout? But more importantly, I'm most disturbed about a probability threshold here because it's ignoring the variability that could be there by the reset. Why isn't the fair value threshold the right thing here if it's in the next memo? Because if you've got a low probability event, but if there's a huge implication in terms of cash flows, isn't that going to introduce potentially enough variability if the fair value is significant that you ought to kick out? So I don't like the remote threshold. I don't like the remote threshold, period. But if I were going to be voting for B, it does not seem to me a remote threshold is the right thing remotely. It should be at least a fair value threshold because it's P times Q, and if you're trying to assess whether variability is significant, that's the way to do it.
But if it's not remote, the fair value is going to be very small.
Right.
So I don't understand what you mean by
that. That's not true. If the reset is 500 basis points, or who knows what it is.
But you would agree in evaluating that fair value, you would consider the likelihood of the contingency being resolved. In evaluating.
Absolutely.
So if it's remote, that's going to discount the amount you're talking
correct.
About.
But if it's a huge amount, it still could be material and significant. So why is the staff coming up with an alternative in the next memo to say it should be a fair value assessment to be able to do it, which is a P times Q assessment, and just a P assessment here? It's different staff, I understand. The A staff on this one is the C staff on the next one. But the complexity that's being introduced in this model with five different thresholds throughout it, I would assert it's not a principle-based approach anymore.
Okay. Tuck?
Yes. I just want to echo what Hans said. Actually, this project started after the financial crisis. So everybody thought before financial crisis, there are lots of trigger events. It seems to be remote, but it was not remote at the financial crisis. So therefore, I think we should go down the path of alternative A.
Yes, thank you. Just a question. What is the feedback about this issue that I'm very curious, because basically approach A is conceptually good and the best for the everything, the you know, classifications of, but if you are considering, when you consider approach B is a kind of a response to the feedback from the practical world, you know, so if we are going to propose a more acceptable, you know, standard rather than some ideally correct or best one, so I wonder what specific feedback from the outside, you know, on this issue, whether they want the remote probability or they are satisfied with non-genuine, very extremely rare. You know, threshold. So that's why it's easy. If we think there's no, you know, they are going to accept our original proposal, then we don't have to discuss, because you know, alternative A is much better, you know, conceptually. So that's why I'm asking you, what specific feedback.
And maybe if I could quickly respond from my first nine perspective first, and basically echo what Raul said in his tee up. That from IFRS 9 perspective, we really didn't hear any concerns about the current non-genuine threshold, with the only exception of bail-in instruments, which are captured specifically in alternative C, and also certain prepayment features, which are captured in another memo. But other than that, we haven't really heard any concerns with the non-genuine. That's my perspective.
And from the FASB's perspective, the only reason we are bringing this up is because we heard significant feedback from our constituents saying that there are features which have remote possibility of happening. That's why the reason their fair value is very small. And the expectation is that on that instrument, the only thing the holder would collect would be principal and interest. And even with those kind of instruments, those are being kicked out to fair value net income, and they were concerned about that. So
you have an instrument where the component that has very little fair value because there's a remote contingency is now causing the entire thing to be fair valued, and the changes in fair value that are reflected are unrelated to that contingency, and they are directly related to changes in interest and credit, which, had it not had that contingency, would have been an amortized cost. And that's why I think people are saying the tail's wagging the dog. The thing that's minor from a valuation standpoint is causing the other aspects to be valued. That's really why we've gotten this.
That's fair, but obviously what we're trying to balance with is if we go from a bifurcation environment to one where the entire instrument is measured at amortized cost, even if that feature has a small value on day one, it does exist, and its value could change over time.
It could, and as it got past the remote threshold, then it would trigger and be
cause
right?
reclassifications, and then there's complications. So that's what we're trying to balance.
But that's why I'm asking now. We have to be very careful in making a final conclusion. Yesterday we have considered a kind of acceptability of our standards. So we got a good feedback from the market. So we throw back all our conclusions to the other ones. So this is the same thing. If we do not allow bifurcation, many companies are really worrying about their convertible bond, for example. If we do not give us some kind of, even though that's complex, but if we do not give us some kind of some flexibility, they might not be upset, and they will keep asking us to not to accept the current proposal, please change this. So that will happen in maybe 3 months later or 4 months later. So that's, I'm thinking, we have to be very careful, not just idealistically, this is correct standard. That's correct, that's good. But if we think some kind of feedback or acceptance, then we must be deciding the good conclusion at this time, not to repeat. There are some kind of trial and errors,
Gary?
I think there's good arguments for both A and B. I just want to test understanding under B before I make my next comment. Regardless of whether it's remote or something more frequently remote, if you're only getting P&I cash flows, I'm sorry, you pass. Right. So
that's question one.
What's that?
That's question one.
Yep. So if you're only getting non-P&I cash flows, then whether or not you're at remote or greater than remote, it doesn't make all that much of a difference, correct, if you're only getting P&I back, correct?
Yes.
So I think there's good arguments, like I said, there's good arguments for both. My guess is if we stated A, is a lot of the features, because the difference between A and B is the degree of how remote is non-genuine in some respects. I think what practice will perhaps change, that things that would just be commonly thought of as remote today will now be argued that they're not genuine tomorrow. I think that's what will happen if we need to get into A. So
is that a problem?
I don't know if it's a problem. I'm just making an observation. I think, no one thinks about non-genuine if remote gets you where you need to get to today. If it doesn't get where you need to today, you're going to start revisiting it. Are they non-genuine?
The whole concept of non-genuine, I have difficulty with. I mean, people put provisions in contracts for reasons.
What is he saying? Negotiated item.
Well, I do worry about, if the main objective is to get principal and interest back for the person who's advancing the money, they're going to be inclined to want to put as many protective rates in there and features that go in their direction, maybe the remote. But you don't necessarily want to preclude protective rights from result in true protective rights causing any problems.
I think, though, it would be pretty hard to argue that covenants are non-genuine.
Yeah. And also non-genuine, just to be clear, is already a concept in IFRS. So there's already in the IFRS world an understanding of what it means. And basically it screens out things that aren't substantive.
In the US world, I think you'd be hard-pressed to have an auditor accept that there's a provision in the contract that's not genuine.
Yeah, it's a negotiated bargain for term, presumably.
Mary?
Again, question for the staff and some of Larry's comments about the kind of protective rights that might be written in a contingent basis. If the consequence is a non-cash event, is that just not relevant to the whole classification? So, for example, getting a board seat, getting the right to approve expenditures in excess of X level, are those types of features just out, have no impact on classification?
That's my understanding, yes.
Okay. I want to check. So we're only talking about contingencies that affect cash flows, whether it's additional cash flows or loss of cash flows because of conversion to equity.
Broadly speaking, if you were going to get shares of a particular value or something like that, that's included.
Keeping the cash flow.
Yeah. Okay. Just want to check that.
If it impacts your return and your principal, those contingencies. So if it doesn't impact your return, basically the principal or interest, it doesn't. So board seats, and those kind of things are
okay. I support B. And some of us worry about the reclassification. Of course, it will increase the complexity, but the remote threshold is very high. And think about our requirement in other standards or in 9. We require reclassification from the biggest model perspective. And we have, company have to redo some things because of the consolidation judgment or jump arrangement judgment. And all these kind of requirements will create complexities. I don't think, people against us so much on these requirements, So I don't think complexity should be a big concern for us. And someone mentioned about convertible bonds. Please keep in mind, we decide in this minor amendment, we will not bring back the discussion about bifurcation. And if we move to A, my concern is, most of the convertible bonds will be fair value at all. And then the cry over whether we should bring bifurcation back again will become louder and louder. So I personally will favor B.
But just to Cheng Wu's point, going back to his question earlier, we haven't had concerns in the IFRS world raised about convertible bonds. People have sort of got past that and acknowledge that there is information content and fair value for convertible bonds. The feedback we've had has been very specific. It's been bail-in bonds, where the contingency is based on a bank not having Tier 1 capital, which they view as being remote and therefore shouldn't change the accounting, and prepayments at par, which is addressed in the other paper. Those are the two issues that we've had from our constituents.
So, and I think there is agreement around the table that bail-in bonds would even if you went for variant B, would not
be amortized. Yeah.
I'm not sure we can be that black and white. I think it would depend. Yes. I think it will depend on the market and circumstances and the triggers for the bail-in.
Yeah, it depends.
Yeah. A is the only thing. A and C both answer bail-in bonds. B is...
A won't answer bail-in bonds.
Oh, A. I'm sorry. But I thought A would have said that.
They're genuine. They're very
right, so that would be a problem. I read A as bail-in bonds are a problem.
Okay,
so C is an exception.
C is designed to try and deal with bail-in
bonds. Right, and B is assess the likelihood of needing to do the bail-in.
So C was designed to target the particular issue that was raised about bail-in bonds. B is broader, and A just says keep what we expose.
Right.
One of the observations that I would make about this is that if you go back to the original premise of why amortized cost makes sense, we say in a broad sense that the investor is holding to collect principal and interest, and that's related to the business model, but it is about how they're anticipating to realize the value of the instrument. Okay. And we also very, you know, loosely have always said that this was designed to capture, you know, plain vanilla type cash flows, even though the guidance is morphing here. When you introduce this type of a feature into an instrument, the investor is no longer just watching principal and interest. They're also watching other types of movements in the market, and they have to anticipate, you know, the likelihood or unlikelihood of those things. Fair value starts to become much more relevant. And the other consideration, obviously, is then when do you decide to reclassify this instrument from amortized cost to fair value when this event is triggered? So it's introducing a complexity to the value realization, the broad value realization expectation of the investor that I think, you know, is too far to one direction.
I think we've heard all the arguments.
And I think that that's the primary reason. Mm-hmm.
And Daryl's out.
Where's Daryl?
Any more arguments?
Do I see it right that Perry and C doesn't have any takers? So it's really between A and B?
Yeah.
Yeah? Oh, let's...
Hans, could I maybe make one final observation while we're waiting for Daryl? And that's the questions that Gary earlier raised and also to Russ's instrument. I think it's also very important to remember what you just voted for on P&I contingencies. So, for example, if you have a feature where the trigger is a covenant violation, it's not in itself sort of a trigger that is inconsistent with solely P&I. So you will look at the trigger and you will look at the resulting cash flows, and you might conclude that some of those instruments actually are addressed in the first half of the paper. So they would not result in non-P&I cash flows, and you wouldn't even need the CMOL threshold to deal with them.
So what about Jim's example of not filing your financial reports on time?
Doesn't matter. If the interest rate goes up because of that, it's still P&I. Because it's okay as long as if they pay penalty of $50,000, then that's an issue.
Yeah.
Because it could be non-P&I. Or if they get a warrants, that's an issue. But if they get interest only, higher interest, that's fine.
What? Market interest.
You got to distinguish protective covenants from other things.
Warrants are not cash flows.
But they are, because it's return. It's not cash flows, it's return. So it doesn't matter what you get.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Depends what the
I had the same question in the Ed session.
Okay.
Warrants are included with cash flows.
Yeah.
I is B first. Who supports variant A?
Come on, Hans.
PK, I've never seen that work.
I always follow PK. He's the guide of my life.
Hans, you have a very sad life.
Hey, watch.
Windy road.
Hey, watch your words.
Dalai Lama from there.
Happy as B.
Good.
A?
For A?
Three.
All the users.
So who is going to, now we should ask B. First of all, convergence, is that very important here, or is it?
Well, maybe you should see what would be voted on.
What? Yes, and who, test B, who supports B?
How many did we have?
That's four?
11.
Yeah.
Four.
Yeah. And the ISB?
And what was the vote?
At 11 for A.
So if we have one FASB board member to change their mind, we'd be converged, right?
Given these votes, it's fair to ask the FASB first if anybody would like to change their vote for convergence. That's not the case.
What if we
I'd have to
think about it in the context of the broader model, and if the question is, would you object? I don't know. I think, in the context of this broader model that we're building.
Listening to the reason for why most people were concerned about A, I wonder if we did some more work on clarifying this protective feature idea, whether that would help.
Yeah. Sounds like it was all about protective rights.
It is. That's the way I look at it.
I don't know if you can.
Okay, I think that's a good solution. Does this bring us to the end of
one more paper left?
But which one?
246.
ISB?
6F. 6F.
Oh, okay.
So the prepayments paper, agenda paper 6F, memo 246, is broken up into two sections. The first section discusses prepayment and extension features that result in cash flows that are solely P&I, while the second section discusses prepayment and extension features that result in cash flows that are not solely P&I. There are questions to the boards at the conclusion of both sections. For contingent prepayment and contingent extension features that result in cash flows that are solely P&I, the paper discusses whether the nature of the trigger event in itself should impact the classification of a financial asset. Consistent with the staff analysis and recommendation in the contingencies paper, staff recommend that the guidance on contingent prepayment and extension features should be clarified to indicate that the nature of the trigger event in itself is not a determinative factor in assessing whether the contractual cash flows are solely P&I. However, the nature of the trigger can be a helpful indicator in assessing whether the contractual cash flows are solely P&I. The question to the boards is, do the boards agree with the staff recommendation?
Any disagreements?
No? Okay. The second part of the paper discusses prepayment and extension features that result in cash flows that are not solely P&I. Staff has developed three alternatives for the board's consideration. Alternative A proposes to retain the existing guidance in IFRS 9 and the FASB's proposed ASU. That is, a prepayment feature that results in cash flows that are not solely P&I is not consistent with the P&I condition unless the feature is non-genuine. Alternative B is similar to alternative B in the contingencies paper in that the current non-genuine probability threshold would be replaced with a lower probability threshold of remote. And this alternative would apply to all prepayment features that could result in non-P&I cash flows. Alternative C, the guidance in IFRS 9 and the FASB's proposed ASU would be amended to require financial assets with prepayment features at the contractually stated par amount plus accrued and unpaid interest to be classified at amortized cost, provided the fair value of the prepayment feature on initial recognition by the current holder is insignificant. All other prepayment features will continue to be treated in accordance with the guidance in IFRS 9 and the FASB's proposed ASU. So essentially alternative C is alternative A with an exception for prepayments at par. So some staff members support alternative B, some others support alternative C. Those staff members that support alternative B believe that as long as the probability of a non-P&I prepayment feature being exercised is remote, such a feature should not determine the classification of the entire instrument. When the probability of exercise is remote, there's an expectation that the cash flows will be simple and consistent with the notion of principal and interest. Those staff that support alternative C believe that measuring financial assets at other than fair value through P&L when such assets have genuine non-P&I cash flows would be inconsistent with the board's objective that only simple financial assets should be measured other than fair value through P&L. They're also concerned about potential operational complexities and implications on comparability of lowering the probability threshold and the resulting need to require reclassifications. In addition, these staff are concerned that from an IFRS 9 perspective, replacing the non-genuine threshold with a remote threshold would go beyond the scope of the limited amendments to IFRS 9. However, these staff members are sympathetic to amortized cost treatment for financial assets that otherwise meet the solely P&I condition but are originated or acquired at a significant premium or discount to par and are prepayable at par. They note that under most circumstances, these prepayment features are not likely to be exercised, for example, purchase credit impaired loans. Accordingly, the staff recommend that such financial assets are measured at amortized cost if the fair value of the prepayment feature on initial recognition is insignificant. The first question the staff would like to ask the boards is, for prepayment features that result in cash flows that are not solely P&I, do the boards prefer alternative A, B, or C?
So I have to go back to the flowchart to figure out how this model works. But if I buy a loan, buy a debt instrument that has a prepayable feature, and I buy it subsequent to its origination in an interest rate environment such that I pay a significant or I pay significantly less than the contractual amount. All right, so a deep discount. Do I first evaluate the interest rates or the payment features of the instrument unto itself to determine that they're solely principal and interest? How do I get through this flowchart?
You mean, do you look at if there are time value components that are meant that are modified?
Let's say that the instrument has no
from
bells and whistles.
Bottom.
What?
From top to bottom.
It's too bad this is being videoed. All he's saying is par is 1,000, fair market value is 850, you paid 850, it's prepayable at any point in time.
And it bears interest at 8%.
But you don't expect the issuer, then the interest rate was market at the time, the discount reflects the market, you have no basis to believe the issuer will seek to prepay early because of current interest rates. What do you do?
Well, no, but I think they're, you know, for all I know, interest rates could change again such
right.
that it would be prepaid.
Right.
How do I evaluate it?
But so if the interest rate is fixed at 8% and there's no other bells and whistles, as somebody mentioned, there's you're going to get through, you start from the top, but you get through all of this, all of the boxes down to the prepayment section. Because if there's nothing else that's modified, if it's just
right.
simply a fixed interest rate, there's nothing else to analyze.
Right. So you
so
get
you go straight to the prepayment.
Yeah, and A would say it's a problem, B would say it's probably not, and C would say it's not, right? Because it's prepayable far.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. Is that right?
Yeah.
A would
you're
say
right.
it's a problem. B would depend on probability.
Yeah.
C would say it's not a problem.
No.
And as long as the fair value is insignificant of the prepayment.
But you would think the fair value insignificant in relation to the remoteness would have some correlation.
Yes.
But,
yes.
But you understand.
But did
you understand why you get that,
right.
don't you?
Because you're right. Good point. You're right.
B is B updated. C is C. So you have that peace of mind.
So the
fact that I can get a lot more money than what I originally thought I was going
to
get.
That's why you get to the prepayment question, because if you look at the amount you paid versus the contractual cash flows, given the expectations of when it pays, you'd conclude that it's principal and interest because it's a vanilla instrument, all things.
Versus if I originated
But if in theory it could prepay tomorrow, the question is, does the fact that you could get this really high return causes a question mark, and that's why then you go and ask a prepayment question.
Doc, I support alternative C. My first preference was bifurcation, but we are not going to discuss bifurcation again. The good thing about alternative C is actually the prepayment feature should be bifurcatable. And it is better than bifurcation, because in the case of bifurcation, you have to remeasure every time. But if we choose alternative C, you just estimate the fair value of the prepayment feature once. So it's much better and simpler than the bifurcation. So therefore, I support alternative C.
Patricia.
I don't have much problem in the case where you're buying the loan or originating the loan at a discount and you might have a windfall when it prepays. But I have some significant concerns about where you are buying it at a premium and it prepays at par and you might not recover your investment. And so I'm inclined to stay with A.
Obvious.
And the other test probably has the same.
No. Actually, mine's more of an observation and a question. When you look at these two issues together, one would hope, I think somebody on the outside reading the final standard would hope that there'd be some consistency, right, in the logic of thinking here in the principle that you'd apply so you could get to the same answer. And so the choices that lead you down that path, one could argue, are A and C. But in C, you're making, in this paper, you're making an exception. Alternatively, B and B, you're pretty consistent, and I like consistency. And hence, one of the reasons why I said at the end of the day, I think, you know, I'm empathetic to that path. So I think the staff should think about guiding the boards about writing a principle for which they're going to be consistent in the interpretation of these complex features. And err on that side than, you know, the theories I was pontificating on before, which I truly believe in, but I think we should be consistent here. That's all.
Larry?
When I buy this thing at a discount, all right, can I take that discount and separately calculate the fair value associated with the prepayment feature? All right, so offline somebody can explain that to me.
Steve?
If I buy at a discount and it's prepayable, we don't expect prepayments because of the interest rate structure, but we do expect prepayments for other reasons, what happens then? So if I have a mortgage and I move house, I have to pay back my mortgage.
And you have
even though it's economically in my interest to keep it because of the interest rate structure, I still have to pay it back. So under C, is there a fair value for that? I noticed the words from the borrower's perspective.
I wonder in your example whether you would have actually a significant premium, a discount, and you might. I must say that these alternatives B and C were primarily targeted at the situations like purchase credit impaired instruments where you do have a significant discount. But in your example, if you have a significant discount on this financial asset, and it has value because for whatever reasons you do expect that they will prepay, that you will or you may, you likely will realize this huge return, and then it would be inconsistent with the solely P&I condition.
Agree. What about Pat's example of buying at a premium? Let's suppose it's a five-year instrument, but it's prepayable at par from year three. And we expect everybody to prepay at year three because interest rates have gone down. Is that okay?
I think when somebody buys something at a significant premium, you would expect that they're going to be pretty thorough in their assessment of the likelihood of the timing of prepayment.
Well, in that case, you would actually price it based upon an assumption that everybody would prepay.
So you're going to make
your
assumptions on when prepayments are going to occur, and that's what happens with the mortgage-backed securities and all of that stuff. And so that's sort of implicit in the premium that you're willing to pay. But I think you would need to consider the possibility that it could get prepaid at more quickly than what you expected and look at the value of that. But the thinking that I think underlies all of this is that people should be making those assessments anyway when they're making the decision of how much they're going to pay for those instruments. And if it does have a significant value, then I think then that's why we think it shouldn't be measured at amortized cost if that would result in cash flows that aren't P&I.
See, I agree that people make those assessments when you're paying a premium. I'm not so sure they make them as much when there's a discount. I know.
So you...
like the distressed debt and things like that.
Yeah.
I support alternative C. I think in general,
you know, when someone is investing in an asset, they sort of know what the prepayment features and dates and terms are going to be, and that factors into the pricing that they're paying for it. And so with that in mind, it's hard to envision that you're going to get such a huge significant premium or huge significant discount that's at variance with when it could be prepaid. At the same time, I think people that are, I'll call it debtor-creditor type investors, you know, expecting to get, when you're into a fixed income, a fixed rate security, you expect to get your par back. I think that's implicit in it, or you're assuming you plan to hold it to maturity or to prepayment. But I think that's all those things. I think C is clearly, at least 95% of the time, the right answer.
Hal?
Yeah, I agree with Gary, and I just want to go back to a comment that Sue made. When you're deciding whether I want to buy a particular bond, whether it's trading a premium or discount, I'm anticipating, as Gary said, a prepayment. So therefore, that's factored into my yield, which is basically principal and interest.
Yeah.
But I heard you come to exactly the opposite conclusion, that it wasn't.
I wasn't trying to. I think they do take it into account, and that's why I think the fair value, or the remote for that matter, are both helpful things, because otherwise something which technically could happen but nobody at all has any concept that would actually occur could drive the classification, because it's so unlikely, it's not the expert.
Yeah, I, to me it's just part of principal and interest, and that's why I'm in C.
Carol Buck?
I prefer alternative B. To Pat's point, for consistency, for one reason, I think it's consistent with my vote on the previous issue on contingencies, and I think that that would explain why I wouldn't prefer A. And with regard to why I would choose B instead of C, I would prefer to consider the likelihood of prepayment on any type of prepayable feature, not just those that are prepayable at par. I do recognize that alternative C would not require the continuous reassessment, but I'm willing to accept that in alternative B for what I consider to be a more pure answer.
Martin?
And I'm also for B, because same reason I voted, I think, in the previous decision, also for B, but also I think to determine really the fair value of the prepayment feature would be a difficult task, and I don't think that is really what we should require, and I think then to judge, people heard, okay, remote is already difficult, but then to come up with a fair value on this prepayment feature in these circumstances would be even more difficult. So I, this is an additional argument which I think, okay, we should go for B.
Ready to pass. Oh, Russ, sorry.
I just had a quick question about alternative C. The alternative C is limited to only those instruments that are prepayable at par. Right? So if you had something that was prepayable at, say, 102, which is not uncommon, CK, it's not.
I know.
So then you don't get C.
I think you're. Yeah.
Why is that?
I think that we're trying to shoot for par because we didn't want a whole broad spectrum, but I think you're right. You thought about the words post in the paper. Already, if you have prepayments, you can have variation around par and interest as long as it's sort of reasonable, so it's sort of in the ballpark, if you like. So I think in its final articulation, if we went with C, it would need to have that as well. So not so black and white, as long as it's sort of reasonable consideration for the principal and interest. Or par, then I think so. I think it needs to be broadened slightly.
I don't understand that.
Yeah.
I'm sure, you know, I just don't understand how wide are you going to open that up? Principal is not defined as par amount. Principal is defined as what you paid for it.
Yep.
So having somebody shoot for principal and interest, I'm not sure helps.
I think we already have words in 9, if my memory serves me well, that talks about
reasonable compensation for early termination of the contract. So in Russ's example, this additional 2 would get using that language.
I was just thinking C.
No, I understand. I understand your point.
But reasonable compensation could be what they pay for, but why would they, if I bought it at 60 and I'm getting 100, that's not a reasonable compensation.
And that is why we need an exception to begin with.
I was saying, you, C could...
I know your point, though. wanted to raise that, but they're coming picky, so I just left it.
Oh, so let me do it. Okay, thanks.
102,
I appreciate
it. Was, it's a situation, yeah.
Jim?
I'd love to see those words and how that works, because I don't know how we would say any amount is unreasonable compensation when that's the compensation somebody negotiated. I don't know how you would distinguish between reasonable and unreasonable compensation.
At the moment, we say reasonable consideration for time value of money, or it's linked to the P&I concept.
Okay, somebody said reasonable compensation before. I didn't know how you would figure that out.
A question on this, is that linking back to the language that's in one of these papers about penalties that compensate for the lost yield? Would it be that tight?
I think we need to look at it carefully, because we already have words in 39 as well that talk about approximately equal to. So I think we need to look at not having it so hard. So the intention is broadly to be the 100 plus interest, mm-hmm. but we need to be careful not to block out something that's obviously trying to target that, but it's not exactly right.
Okay, I think we come to a conclusion. ISB first. Who supports variant A?
I can live with C, but definitely A.
B? B? C?
Ten.
So,
what should we assume from the first vote? That kind of would change my mind. If we went with remote in the first vote.
Right now, I think the majority is view B in the first vote. Right? Mm-hmm. So, how many, by show of hands, how many members of the FASB vote for alternative A? One? B? See, glad I added up to seven.
Okay.
Now, just one thing. If the majority of the vote was view A in the first paper, you would vote for A or C?
I would have ended
vote
up
for C.
And I would have accepted C.
So
all
this right. Is still subject to.
Subject to. I think we're going to.
Code of work yeah. Stuff. Yes?
Yeah.
Okay, so this brings us to the end of the joint session with the FASB. We thank our colleagues for coming over, and we wish them a safe journey home.